Hello, we're going to get started. We're on the record. Thanks. We're going to call the Thursday, June 12th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules.
Okay, subtle of you.
Well, the gavel wasn't working. It is now. We're going to meet in subcommittee. We have four measures on the agenda. For those of you interested, and it doesn't look like the crowd is here, the baseball bill will be heard at approximately 4 o'clock. About 4 o'clock, we think. So we need to deal with the other bills first. We're going to open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 132. I think this is going to be what is commonly called a gut and stuff.
So, Madam Chair, the currently Senate Bill 132 increases the maximum civil penalty for violation of election law from $250 to $1,000. What you have is the dash 2. There are copies of the dash 2 on the table. The dash 2 replaces the bill, deletes unfulfilled pledges that are not legally enforceable from the definition of contributions for purposes of reporting political contributions and expenditures.
We have our
here's the unfulfilled pledges.
Holy smokes.
Smith is here on a different bill. Which is, I think it's your bill.
Okay. All right. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 132. Sorry for you folks that got all excited, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 899. Representative Tootie Smith, come on up.
Madam Co-Chair, Senate Bill 899 requires Oregon motor vehicle license plates to be manufactured in the state of Oregon. It also declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Brown. I'm Representative Tootie Smith, House District 18, Molalla, Oregon. This is an interesting bill. I've been working on it since the interim last November. We had interims committees in the interim to discuss the fact that Oregon license plate contractors not only sent out of state but out of the country to Nova Scotia, Canada. As you know, we have a company here in Oregon that makes license plates, and they've been doing it since 1917. And they have advanced through all the years of the many technological changes to do all the upgrades that we now requires of license plate manufacture. And we have some people with some samples that can show you that later. This bill has taken many different routes. It passed the House, I think, with only four negative votes on an economic impact statement must be done when awarding license plate contracts. And doing so, we would take into economic considerations of loss of jobs and what happens when Oregonians lose their jobs. They go on unemployment. They possibly could go on Oregon health plan and food stamps. Well, in our conversations with the governor, he has also been following this issue since the campaign season and the interim. And what he would like to do, he would like to make license plate language in the printing statute, which would allow utilize the 10% preference granted to all state companies performing printing work. And when we first considered this bill, we thought we could go with what the governor wanted or with what the economic impact statement. And we chose the economic impact statement because our hearings during the interim, the Attorney General's office would come in and try to justify the fact that license plates were indeed not considered printing. And when you see the technology, I think you will probably might agree that they are printing. And so this is really kind of an about-face, but it's something that I'm wholly supportive of. My main goal is to keep the license plate printing here in Oregon. The interesting thing about this company, Irwin Hodson in Portland, is it manufactures license plates for many states across the United States. Prisoners in Oregon do not make license plates, as in some states. At this point, I don't think they ever will because it's too expensive for the startup cost to be involved in that. So that's where we're at. We'd like the license plate contract to stay in the state of Oregon for Oregon license plates. What is the issue is the new crater plate license. Now, that's a flat type of plate that does not have the raised embossing. And what that is you have your metal plate, as you're all familiar with, but then there's a film that goes over the top of that, and that goes through a series of I don't want to get too technical. I don't want to speak out of turn here. But that goes through a series of printing specifications heating, cooling, or whatever, to get that on there and to make it a permanent fixture. So, Senator Brown, I'm extremely thankful and grateful for your interest in this bill. I really do appreciate it. I think it's any time we can save jobs and keep them in the state of Oregon, it does us all well and it does Oregonians well.
Any questions for Representative Smith? Thanks for joining us. Seeing that we have a quorum, we're going to move to a full committee on rules. And Representative Smith, you're welcome to stay, and I'll invite other folks on this bill up or whatever you choose. I don't know how busy your schedule is at this point.
I'll stay for a little while, but thank you, Senator Brown.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Are you in questions yet?
Sure.
Okay. This question, and maybe this was already covered, I apologize, I'd step aside, is for Jim, not for Representative Smith. In your statement of what the measure does, it requires Oregon motor license plate law to do manufacture in Oregon. I don't read that in the bill. So could you explain where we're requiring them to be manufactured in Oregon?
Well, if you look on it, this is Jim Steinbridge, committee staff. If you look on lines 10 through 13, this is where I picked this up. It says all printing, binding, and stationery work for the state or any county shall be performed within the state. We're adding, including the manufacturer of motor vehicle registration plates and plates required to be affixed to motor vehicles.
Okay, thank you, because my understanding was this just put printing or declared license plates as being a part of a printing process, which gives a preference to Oregon companies.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, Madam Chair. I believe that this bill does both.
Right.
Okay.
There is, you can see, as provided in subsection 2, so there are
right.
Exceptions.
So. Senator, your question, Senator Beyer.
Well, I guess I just want to be clear that the subsection 2B, what doesn't that say if you can't beat the price by 10%, it can go outside of state?
Let's see the 10%.
That's the printing preference, and that's a different statute, apparently.
Okay.
I just want clarification. I mean,
okay.
I'm a co-sponsor of the bill. I never seen it described quite that bluntly before.
Well, I think that's the one sentence. I think if you go to the background, it explains it a little bit further, but I understand what you're saying. So, well, we'll get the answer to your questions, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay, let's Grover Simmons. Is it Tom Brown? No relation. And Harvey Matthews, why don't you come on up? Is Kelly Taylor here? Is she here? We'll get her on.
Yeah, she's behind the TV.
Okay. Good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Pacific Printing and Imaging Industry, and more particularly the Irwin-Hodson Company, which manufactures vehicle license plates. Much of my testimony will repeat what Representative Smith just mentioned, but in any event, Irwin-Hodson is an old line company in Portland. They're 109 years old. They've been making license plates for 86 years, since 1917, and it's also a large commercial printing company. And as all of you on the committee know, the Portland company lost the license plate contract to another company in Nova Scotia, Canada, last year. Irwin-Hodson's bid was 6.5% higher than the Canadian bid. That amounts to 2 cents per plate. So in an effort to bring this work back to Oregon, a bill was introduced on the House side which would have taken into account the cost impact of losing salaries and wages of 15 employees and losing taxes, workers' comp, unemployment insurance. That bill was House Bill 2846, and that passed the House on a vote of 53-4. We came over here, and then we got a call from the governor's office requesting that Representative Tootie Smith and I come to that office to discuss a completely different approach to bringing the work back to Oregon. The governor's office recognized the complexity of the cost impact analysis, and they wanted to avoid that. And so they said that if we would agree to put the subject in the public printing statute, the governor would support the amended bill. We agreed, and the governor's office took care of having the amendment drafted. To move the subject along, Senator Brown then introduced a new bill, Senate Bill 899, which we are discussing at this point. And this bill does two things only. It places the manufacturing of license plates in the public printing statute, and it requires the Department of Transportation to put the license plate contract out to bid in 2003. And by putting this subject in the public printing statute, it allows the Portland manufacturer to utilize the 10% preference granted to all in-state companies performing public printing work. That law has been on the books for many decades, and I looked it up since drafting this testimony. It's like 71 years that bill has been in the statute. The amended law in 899 would not guarantee, to get to Senator Byers' question, would not guarantee the license plate contract will come back to Oregon, but it incorporates an advantage which would be a great help in determining the lowest responsible bidder. And had this law been on the books last year, it would have saved the account and kept the work in Portland. One final point. There are only two private sector companies in North America which make license plates. One is the Portland company, and the other one is in Nova Scotia, Canada. With Oregon facing an 8% unemployment situation, it seems like better public policy to at least try to keep this work at home rather than send it to Canada. So I urge you to pass Senate Bill 899 and help move it one step closer to the governor's desk for signature. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you.
Thanks. I'm going to ask folks to hold questions until we go through the panel. Tom Brown.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to support Grover with any questions that might come up later. I don't have a prepared statement right now.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Senator Brown. Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries. We represent over 20,000 of Oregon's businesses and over 350,000 of the workforce. We're here today in support of Senate Bill 899 because it represents a creative solution to a simple problem, namely, how do we make sure that costs of contracts for license plates represent the actual impact on our economy? This bill is important both practically and symbolically. Practically, it saves Oregon jobs, it puts money in the hands of Oregonians, and helps fund state services through the income tax. And symbolically, it represents government making every effort to understand the long-term impact of financial decisions on indigenous Oregon businesses and make every effort to save Oregon jobs. So in summary, we strongly support Senate Bill 899 and wish to thank you, Senator Brown, for bringing this forward. Also the governor's office and Representative Tootie Smith and working hard on this.
Thank you. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Question for the entire panel, whoever wants to answer it. Under this bill, won't the cost of license plates go up? And I just need, it needs to be stated for the record, shouldn't we have the taxpayer in mind to make these costs as low as possible?
Tom, you want to? Sure, I'll address that. Chair, members of the committee, if we look over the last three contracts with the license plates that have been led by Oregon, they have gone from $2.60 to $2.40, and I think the current rate is around $2.21. The economy, the type of work, the way that the plates are being made are constantly being improved, which, of course, until it gets down to the absolute cost of materials, you're still got some movement in there. This bill, if you look at it, there's a 10% number in there. The number right now that these plates were bid at was substantially less than the 10% that would be the cushion that this bill would allow for us. So would they go up? Well, the Canadians right now, I believe, won the bid by 6%. So technically, there would have been a 4%. So instead of paying the 2.5 cents to Canada, you would be paying roughly 2.8 cents, which was still less than the last contract that the state of Oregon picked up on. The plates are constantly going down across the nation when you look at the type of automation and so on that can be implemented in it. I'm not exactly sure, but I believe the DMV has a set amount that they round up to the next number on the amount that they bring to the DMV offices. And so as long as you're under that 249 or whatever that number is, or above the 251, it's either rounded up or rounded down for administrative purposes.
Anything further? Go ahead.
Another question for the panel. Do you not agree that the Crater Lake license plate is the most beautiful license plate?
I'm pretty fond of it myself when it's made in Oregon.
I have a couple of questions. My understanding is that the cost of the Oregon company's license plate in terms of ballpark around the rest of the nation, or at least in the lower half, is that your understanding?
Madam Chair, that is the lower third. Yes,
lower
ma'am.
Third.
Let me ask this to be passed out.
It's half for those of us who didn't do well in law school.
That issue was raised around the Capitol building a few weeks ago, and I asked the company if they had any documentation that would help us find the answer. And they did give us this piece of material, and I'll ask Tom Brown to comment on it. But I looked it over, and there were – this is a recitation of the cost paid by each state, and including the District of Columbia. There were four states that didn't report. So I took the balance of the reporting states and divided them into three, drew that line across this page, and Oregon is in the lowest one-third of the nation insofar as cost. So if the question is put, is the company overcharging Oregon for plates, I believe we can definitively answer and say no, that would not hold, that would not be the case, because we are truly in the lowest third in the nation insofar as costs. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's as close as I could get.
It does, and I have one more question, and I've got an ANSI committee because they're anxious to get on and hear the baseball bill. But it's my understanding that the Oregon company had the contract for a number of years, close to 75, 70 years, and that those contracts were generally speaking more than a year. And it's my understanding that the Nova Scotia firm has the contract for a four- or five-year period. My only question for you, my second question for you is a discomfort in passing a bill to change a statute to essentially have the contract be open for bid at this point in time, and how would you folks feel had you been in that same situation?
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that the contract, which was let last year, is a one-year contract. But the purchasing department has the option of rolling it over four times.
Okay.
But it's a one-year contract. And in order to preclude the rollover, we want to be sure that it's open to bid this year. And that's why the second point is in this bill. Now, Tom, is that a correct analysis?
Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. What the deal is to Senator Atkinson's information, if nothing else, this bill would at least give another chance to see where the price of the plates would gravitate to. In years past, that 1 year with the 4 year discretion to extend it has always been in every contract that is left with every state, including Oregon. And that is always a possibility. Sometimes they reopen it. Hawaii does occasionally. Alaska does occasionally. Oregon has, I don't believe, at least in the last 16 years, exercised that option if you're completing the job correctly and to time frames.
Okay. Thank you all very much. We appreciate your testimony. I believe Representative Rosenbaum is here and would like to put her 2 cents in. And then, Kelly, do you want to come on up?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. I am Diane Rosenbaum, representing Hess District 42, but I feel kind of lost because very short. Well, let me just tell you, though, that I've been watching Hearing Room B on television in my office and calling the committee office and calling Mr. Stembridge's line and getting his voicemail, trying to find out where on earth is the Senate Rules Committee. And everybody said, oh, yeah, they're in Hearing Room B. So I patiently waited till the other committee adjourned, which your room is now available. You'll be happy to know.
Thank you. We're not going to move until we need to.
Well, that's why I was not here at the beginning of this hearing, but am here now to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 899, and just very briefly to tell you that the jobs, this is truly a jobs bill from my perspective, that the employer in question, Irwin Hudson, is a good employer in my district and Senator Brown's district as well, that has been around for over 100 years. This work that we're talking about of creating these license plates represents at least 15 really good family wage jobs, and in fact union family wage jobs. So I felt it was really a shame that this work was going across the border. We've been losing many, many jobs across the border in other industries, and these are jobs that we need to hold on to, particularly with an 8.1% unemployment rate in Portland at the moment, and probably when the new rate comes out, from what we see nationally, it's going to be even a little higher. So they're jobs that we can get back. It makes sense to do it the way that this bill proposes, and I would urge your favorable action on Senate Bill 899. And thank you for listening to me.
Thanks, and welcome.
Thank you.
Kelly, take it away.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Tater of the Department of Transportation. I wanted to be here today to answer any questions you might have and just walk you through some of the background on the bill, or the process, I should say, not the bill itself. It's true, Irwin Hudson has had the contract with Oregon for many, many years, although I did find out that the motor carrier plates, until motor carrier was part of the Department of Transportation, apparently when they were PUC, the plates were made up in Canada. So they haven't always been made in Oregon. That was a piece I did not know. When the contract was let last time was the first time that there's been competition for the contract. I mean, it's been put out on a five-year renewable contract. What Mr. Simmons was speaking to is, yes, it's a yearly contract with 4 years renewal, and it's historically always been renewed. So they tend to look at it as a five-year contract renewed in year increments. And the current law talks about low bid, which is exactly what happened. They went out for bid, it came in, and Mike Fries, the state printer, went and looked at both technologies, both the embossed plate, that's the tree plate where the letters are actually stamped in and then painted, and the flat plate, which is used, a sheeting that is painted and then adhered to the plate, which is what's used for Crater Lake, and determined that the embossed plate process is a manufacturing process, because you're taking finished sheeting from another vendor, and you're adhering it to metal plate and then stamping it, and that's a manufacturing process. And that the flat plate, because the sheeting and the metal plate going together is painted, that's a printing process. So just to give you a little history there. When the bids came in, it's the first time. The whole point of the competitive process bid is to get the lowest the best product for the lowest price, and that's exactly what happened. The bids came in, and it's the first time that Irwin-Hodgson's bid went down. And the bid that was awarded is nearly $600,000 a year less than the previous contract. So the cost did go down. The cost on plates, to answer the question about did the price go down, for the tree plates, the price we were paying before was about $267 a pair, and now it's $220 a pair. And for the Crater Lake plates, it was about $454 a pair, and now it's about $359 a pair. So the prices did go down for the plates. I think under the bill, it gives leeway for about a 10% difference, and based on that, between the two bids last time at a 6.5% difference, that would mean in a biennium about $370,000 difference. If it went up to and then if it went to a 10%, it might mean a $300,000 a year difference, or $600,000 a biennium. Just wanted to give you numbers. Chances are if this goes on, you know, the prices could go up, and that's just the way it'll be then. So,
any questions? I think we appreciate your work and making sure you're looking out for taxpayers' interests. I think obviously
it's a balance,
right? And that's the issue we're facing.
You bet.
Right now.
Okay. Just wanted you to know.
Thank you.
You bet.
Do you have any questions? Do you want to do this? Okay, I'm going to close a public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 899.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I move Senate Bill 899 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 899 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion?
I'll be a no.
Okay. Senator Corcoran's a no. If you don't mind, I'm going to carry the bill.
What bill?
Okay.
And my bill.
Motion passes. Okay, let's move on back to Senate Bill 132. And I assume there is a sign-up sheet, which I probably lost. I did. I do. Can I get Joe Kaiser, Kathy Eaton, and Janice Thompson on their way up, and Fred Neal on deck? And Jim, would you explain what we're doing here on this particular bill? I think you already did, but since Jason and I were, and Roger were the only ones here, it's probably worth repeating.
I'll just repeat on the dash two amendments, which members have in the packet. We put a batch out on the table as well. The dash two amendment replaces the bill. It deletes unfulfilled pledges that are not legally enforceable from the definition of contributions for the purposes of reporting political contributions and expenditures. If you look on that amendment, you'll see many pages. The only substantive change is on page two, I believe.
Thank you. Fire away, Joe.
Members of the committee, Senator Co-Chair Brown, Joe Kaiser, Democratic Party political director. We just came here today to support the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 132, and we wanted to take a moment to testify and give you our reasons. Senate Bill 132, including the Dash 2 amendments, would rectify a current problem with the definition of a campaign contribution. Currently, the definition of a contribution includes the following language: any unfulfilled pledge, subscription, agreement, or promise, whether or not legally enforceable, to make a contribution. And then, as an add-on to that, has to be reported. This piece of language requires campaigns that receive a pledge, whether it's real, fictional, non-legally enforceable, to report a pledge during a given reporting period. This creates a reporting issue that many campaigns trying to follow the letter of the law cannot reasonably satisfy. For example, donor number one tells candidate number one he or she will provide $100 in support verbally, hereby making a pledge. The pledge is then supposed to be reported as part of the next feasible report, whether the pledge is received, which would be the making of the pledge to a contribution, or not received, which makes it nothing. During legislative session, this example is even more difficult for the folks sitting in front of us. Donor number one pledges $100 to legislator number one, requiring legislator one to report within 24 hours whether the pledge is viable or not. The legislator, trying to comply, must report the discussion even if the pledge seems unlikely or is fraudulent, according to the definition. This puts a legislator during session at risk to incur fines for not reporting or public scrutiny for reporting a contribution that may be phony or inaccurate. Senate Bill 132 with the Dash 2 amendments would make a simple change to the definition of a contribution, removing the aforementioned language and replacing it with the following language: any signed or legally enforceable agreement to make a contribution. Senate Bill 132 would protect legislators from an overly broad definition that is legally unenforceable. This bill would narrow the criteria and give the Secretary of State an enforceable clause. The language change would still allow for the reporting of pledges if an individual receives a signed, legally enforceable document. This bill will maintain the integrity of Oregon's reporting system, counting all contributions and expenditures and summary reports in the same customary way. And finally, this bill will also leave it up to the Secretary of State to decide through the administrative process how best to certify a legal pledge. So, in short, the Democratic Party of Oregon supports the Dash 2 amendments and encourages the Senate Rules Committee to do so as well.
Thank you. That helps you with half of the committee. Now on to Ms. Thompson.
I'm Janice Thompson with the Money and Politics Research Action Project. And just very simply, it just seems like this is rolling back of disclosure, and that's just not the direction we should be going in. And it just... in the work I do, I have opportunity to talk to, you know, various treasurers, and though they do have, you know, various qualms and questions, this just hasn't like risen to be a number one priority thing to fix. So it just seems like it's moving in the wrong direction.
Thank you. Kathy, welcome.
Kathy Eaton, thank you, Madam Chair. Legal Women Voters of Oregon. Just 2 points that I would like to make, reiterating what Janice has said. The League is always concerned when there may be a reduction in disclosure. That's all we have in Oregon to look at campaign finance. We don't have anything else. So when there's a question of reduction, we're concerned about that. The other thing is that the original 132 raised the fees, the fines for civil penalties. There really is very little money at this point in Secretary of State's Elections Division in any event, Measure 28 not having passed. And this simply, this it seemed to us that it was important that the violations for provisions of election laws should have a meaningful amount attached to them. And so we object to the fact that that's totally eliminated in the amendments. Thank you.
Senator Corcoran.
I just have a question for Mr. Kaiser. You said that the Democratic Party supports the left making care of half the committee. Have you had any discussion with the Republican Party about this?
Senator Corcoran, Madam Co-Chair, yes, I have actually had discussions with Republican Executive Director Amy Casterline, who is my one of my counterparts at the other party. It was their feeling that they thought this amendment was fine, something that would help be helpful to them. Of course, as you know, the Western states conferences in town, they're extremely busy. I couldn't certainly speak for them, but that's been our discussions.
Okay.
Mr. Neal, Fred, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Fred Neal, campaign finance manager for the Secretary of State Elections Division. The Secretary and his office opposes the Dash 2 amendments, and I'm here just to... I'm authorized to deliver that message, but also to explain some of the issues that we have with the Dash 2 amendments. First, this does not seem to be a big problem to us now of reporting pledges. They don't show up as a cash contribution. They're under accounts receivable, and it's a matter of self-reporting by the candidate and her or his treasurer. And it should not affect any bookkeeping problems or issues of the committee or confusion as to the cash balance. We are very lenient as far as if it ends up not being a collectible pledge, that you just stop reporting it as an accounts receivable. And you don't have to account for that. You just, in your next report, don't carry it forward. You have unilaterally decided you're never going to see that money. And so it's not been an enforcement issue for us. We've not imposed penalties. There have been two instances where it has been somewhat of an issue where committees or nascent campaigns, those that knew that they were going to get a ballot measure on the ballot for a forthcoming election and knew that they had money, in one case willed, bequeathed by the time of the election came to pass, a deceased donor to mount a campaign in favor of a ballot measure, and then the committee never reported that as an account receivable until the second until a subsequent report, and so the persons opposing that measure did not know that this was a well-funded measure campaign early on in the race, so that they could go out and raise funds themselves to get their anti-measure message out. And it's very similar to a much great, that was a local bond measure in a central Oregon county just recently, whereas we had a $500,000 case, a similar complaint that was in the general election of 2000 regarding some last minute massive radio, statewide radio buys. If you require us to maintain a burden of proof of something that's legally binding, that it has to be a written instrument or otherwise legally binding, that means that we have an additional hurdle in order to show that that was indeed a contribution that the candidate or ballot measure committee knew they would have available for them in order to go ahead and commit large-scale purchases of radio time or other, you know, pending expenditures. So we're not convinced that this amendment is as simple as it is professed to be, nor that it instills some greater level of integrity in the process.
Thank you, Fred. I guess my question for you would be, I'm assuming if I were to receive a $10,000 pledge from Group X, if I failed to report that, not the money itself, but the pledge, I'm assuming if you found out about it in some way, I could still be fine, correct?
If you failed, Madam Chair, in response to your question, if indeed you failed to amend your report within the new transaction deadline, and again, we're very lenient about that. So if you forgot that somebody verbally promised you a $10,000 check at some point and then remembered and met the... Now, that doesn't apply to the PC-14 situation that Mr. Kaiser brought up, but... that's sort of a judgment call, I think, that any candidate and anyone professing to make a promise of a contribution should address at that time.
Then my other question in terms of the campaign that was willed a donation, in essence, is it certainly possible that that will could have been challenged in court and tied up so the campaign might not have received that?
No, we have sworn testimony from the parties that they were quite confident that they had the funds in hand in the foundation okay. to transfer to the committee once they decided that they would go down to the county clerk's office and file the statement of organization for the committee.
Okay.
Wasn't on death by dignity, I hope.
But again, and I don't know how many years, those are the only enforcement actions that we've even come close to in regards to this matter. So,
any other questions from the committee? What? Okay. Thank you all very much.
You can hold that one.
Madam Chair, are you going to do a work session? Yeah, I'm going to move into a work session. I'm going to close the public hearing, open a work session.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Move the dash two amendments in the Senate Bill 132.
Senator Burdick has moved the dash two amendments.
Senator Beyer.
I can hardly tell him a lot.
Senator Burdick. Senator Beyer.
Okay.
He's the one with
That's
the
okay. He gave my closing speech on a bill he voted against today, so we're even. Senator Beyer.
So moved.
Moves the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 132.
You know, Senator Clarno runs this committee a lot better.
I've noticed that.
Don't let him bug you.
Is there any discussion about the motion?
Madam Chair, I'm disappointed that, I'm concerned about some of the issues that were raised with this amendment, and I'm also disappointed that it did not have the increase in penalties that I think was a good policy, so I'll be opposing these amendments.
Thank you, Senator Burdick. I'm not disputing that there are possible issues raised. The underlying bill had sort of a constitutional issue, so just for your information and those in the crowd. Will you please call the roll on the dash two amendments, please?
Senator Atkinson?
Senator Beyer?
Aye. Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator
Corcoran?
Aye.
Co-Chair Brown?
Aye.
Co-Chair Parno?
Aye.
And Senator Atkinson?
Which one
are we on? 132.
Oh, yes.
Aye. Motion passes. Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 132 to the floor as amended with a two-pass recommendation.
The point of
yes.
Did you get to hear the dash four amendments?
I was not aware there were dash four amendments.
But never mind. Never mind. I'm getting a never mind. Never
okay.
mind.
All right. Senator Byers moves Senate Bill 132 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Parnell?
Aye.
Co-Chair Brown?
Aye. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this?
If you wish.
Sure.
Well, remind me to say yes when I'm closing.
Okay. Senator Beyer will be the carrier. Close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 132. We have left. We have 139.
139.
Yes. Okay. We're going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 139. Jim's going to talk to us about the bill. Once we're done with this bill, we'll move to Hearing Room B for all you excited baseball fans. Where did he go? Oh, he's going to come to the front.
I think you're Madam Co-Chair and members, Jim Stembridge, your committee staff. Senate Bill 139 has to do with the voters' pamphlet. The original bill doubles fees for space in the voters' pamphlet for candidates and arguments.
Okay.
I have worked on your behalf on an additional concept, which is to change the format of the voters' pamphlet itself, as well as changing the fees for space for arguments and candidates. I have an outline of what we have been working on, and I'll ask our staff to pass that out to you. And here are extras to put out also. Our objective, well, the goal was to make the pamphlet smaller, the costs lower, the revenue higher, to reduce the necessary general fund subsidy. And I called it Principles for Preservation of the Oregon Voters Pamphlet because we understand that there will be no general fund or very limited general fund monies available for the voters pamphlet. The objectives were to that we decided to work on for this alternative would be to eliminate the text of ballot measures, to eliminate maps, to eliminate precinct committee person statements, and to include instead a statement of availability from the Secretary of State via the website or by telephone or mail request. We also talked about reducing the space for primary election candidate statements by half at the same price. We have a sample layout of that. We talked about reducing the space for general election candidate statements and also increasing the fees by approximately 3 to 10 times the current fees. We've talked about introducing a sliding fee, reduced space for all measure arguments, and we in this bill also there was a creation of a voters an election account. We changed that to a voters pamphlet operating account. If you look on page 2, you will see the proposed fees. First of all, for the arguments, this is page 2 of my handout here. You see the proposed fees for this alternative. These are reflected in the dash 2 amendments, which you have a copy of. The arguments, is there a sliding scale? $500 for 6 square inches. $500 is the current fee for a half a page. This keeps that fee the same for a greatly reduced size. If you look down the middle of the page, you'll see candidates there. There is no change in fees for the primary, although the space does decrease by 50%. Right now, if you recall that voters pamphlet, there are 2 candidates per page. This would up that to 4 candidate photographs and statements per page. The big price change comes down in the general. The argument stays the same, but the political party and candidate fees for space are increased by a large amount. On page 3, you'll see an example that the Secretary of State put together for us showing how these arguments would be displayed. The 6 square inches you'll see in the upper left-hand corner as an example. On page 4, you'll see an example of 4 candidates per page. This, again, put together by the Secretary of State's office. We had a discussion group that met on May 16th to discuss these basic principles. You'll see the list of people who attended that and who were invited on page 5. On pages 6 and 7, you will see examples that we used to put together what these fees and space would be in a comparison voters pamphlets. Across the top of each page you'll see the current. We used a current matrix of costs, so these are not comparable to exactly what was paid by the Secretary of State for the production and distribution costs. But you will see in general we had an almost $2 million subsidy required for the 2,000 set of voters pamphlets. That includes the primary, the general volume 1, which contains the arguments, and the general volume 2, which contains the candidates. If you look down at the bottom, you'll see what we've proposed on, with the dash 2 amendments. You get, actually with a large voting voters pamphlet like the 2000, you'll get quite a large amount of revenue left over. Here we've calculated it to be $167,000. If you look at a smaller voters pamphlet, which is the 2000 pamphlet, you will see that there was under the current condition and using these same this same cost matrix a deficit of $670,000. With the dash 2 size and fees you come out with a deficit of just $60,000, and that was kind of the goal, was to get the deficits down to the tens of thousands of dollars rather than the hundreds of thousands of dollars. The last page you have, it describes the average cost per household that these get delivered to for space in the voter's pamphlet. Even though the fees, the idea there is that even though the fees have been increased, it is still a reasonable cost for that type of campaign literature. Backing up this information, I have a set of Excel spreadsheets that I use to calculate. I have copies of that I'll just set out here. I've also invited anyone who wants to have originals of those so they can look and see what I did and what errors I may have made. They can look. They can ask me. I will send them those Excel spreadsheets.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Any questions for Jim? All right.
Who won that race in the governor's?
It is my understanding we do not have the time that we need to work the bill today, and no one or folks are just reviewing the dash for amendments. So we would like to set this tentatively over for Tuesday. What would be the date? Does somebody know? 17th. Probably be like a 4 o'clock type hearing. So we will make sure that all the parties, all five of you that are signed up, get notice. And thank you for your time and energy in joining us today.
Madam Chair?
Senator Corcoran.
Is that hearing going to be before or after Sine Die?
I think we're safe to say it's before Sine Die, Senator Corcoran.
Damn.
So with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 139, and we are going to, move to hearing room B.
That's a tough word to remember.
I was going to look for something much, you know,
more elaborate,
much prettier.
Lawyerly.
Migrate.